Good morning, this is Jeff Blankfort, welcome you to the September 25th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that usually comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday I want to open the phones to you, our listeners. Since the beginning of the current century, the Middle East has been dominating the human-made news, and there is no sign of a let-up. Thanks to the pressure of the American people and the stubbornness of the British Parliament, we have just avoided another war, this time with Syria, at least for the moment. President Obama made the region's problems his focus in addressing the UN General Assembly yesterday, while the new president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, did the same, presenting a vastly improved image of his country to the United States and to the world than did his predecessor, while at the same time negotiating teams from Israel and the Palestinian Authority are engaged in talks that experienced observers view as a farce and few expect will lead anywhere. All these issues are related. It's become almost axiomatic to say that the Israel-Palestine conflict is at the heart of all the Middle East problems, and while that may be an exaggeration, there is no question but that Israel's presence in the Middle East has been the major source of trouble in the region since David Ben-Gurion declared Jewish statehood in 1948. Two Sundays ago, on September 15th, in the New York Times, published a hard-hitting essay entitled The Two-State Illusion, which demolished the notion that there will ever be a Palestinian state side by side with Israel, or that it was a good idea. Its author was a University of Pennsylvania political science professor and longtime observer of the Israeli-Palestinian relationship, Ian Lustig. The only solution, if there is one, he wrote, is a single state for both Jews and Palestinians. He makes a powerful argument, so stay tuned for that at 20 minutes past the hour. Meanwhile, let's take a look at the other Middle East news, starting with the arrival in New York of Iran's new president, who appears as interested in a rapprochement with the United States as Ahmadinejad, his predecessor, was in giving Washington the finger. This prospect and the anticipation of Obama's conciliatory words yesterday clearly frightened the powerful pro-Israel establishment, which had a definite fondness for Rouhani's belligerent predecessor. Speaking at one of its annual conferences, a former president of AIPAC, Israel's registered lobby, jokingly described Ahmadinejad as, quote, the gift that keeps on giving. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and his agents in Washington and the media were not shy in expressing their disappointment when Obama chose negotiations with the Russians concerning the removal of Syria's chemical weapons, rather than launching a flood of Tomahawk cruise missiles at Damascus. They remain worried that the message being sent to Iran from the White House is that the military option is no longer really on the table, despite Obama's statement yesterday that, quote, we will not tolerate the development or use of weapons of mass destruction, end quote. Netanyahu is clearly not pleased with Obama's references to Iran at the General Assembly. Iran thinks that soothing words and token actions will enable it to continue on its path to the bomb, Netanyahu said after the president said that Washington was ready to engage diplomatically with Iran over its nuclear program. Netanyahu is doing everything he can to sabotage U.S.-Iranian talks even before they begin. Since he won't have a chance to do that at the UN before next Tuesday when he addresses the General Assembly, he has already let the world, and more precisely President Obama and the Israeli-occupied Congress, know his expectations. A statement from Netanyahu's office issued last Thursday after the Iranian president was interviewed on NBC described Rouhani's remarks about the peaceful aims of Iran's nuclear program and his readiness to pursue diplomacy as an exercise in media spin. The truth test is not Rouhani's words, Netanyahu's statements read, but rather the deeds of the Iranian regime, which continues to aggressively advance its nuclear program while Rouhani is giving interviews. Yuval Steinitz, Israel's Minister for Strategic Affairs, claimed in an interview published the next day in Israel Hayom, a free paper owned by Las Vegas billionaire Sheldon Adelson, that Iran was 6 months away from developing a bomb and that time had run out for negotiations. Netanyahu has been making the same accusation for well more than a decade, despite the fact that international inspectors have never found any evidence supporting such an allegation. What the Israeli Prime Minister is counting on is his country's past success in telling big lies. Repeated often enough, people soon come to believe them. Netanyahu's statement raised the prospect of reheating old disagreements with the Obama administration over the handling of Iran, suggested the Guardian of London. It was fueled, to use the Guardian's term, by an exchange of letters between Obama and Rouhani and talk in Washington of negotiations that could begin removing some of the draconian sanctions that the Congress, pushed by AIPAC, has levied on Iran. Reflecting the Israeli government's concern that the U.S. and Europe may be wavering, Netanyahu told a meeting of his cabinet last week that, quote, the pressure on Iran must be increased and not relaxed, and certainly not eased. Netanyahu has demanded that Iran halt all uranium enrichment, which happens to be legal, remove all enriched uranium from the country, dismantle the Fordo nuclear plant, and stop the plutonium track to a nuclear weapon. If they don't do that, he wants Americans to shed yet more blood for Israel. Netanyahu's army of unregistered foreign agents at AIPAC laid down its requirements in a memo to Congress on Friday. The United States, it said, should synchronize its approach to sanctions with Iran's compliance with United Nations Security Council resolutions. If Iran suspends its nuclear activity, the United States should be prepared to suspend any new sanctions. Note here that AIPAC, speaking for Israel, would give those reading the memo to believe that the Security Council has called for Iran to give up all nuclear activity. It hasn't. Then it says that if it does that, there'll be no reward for Iran, no relief from sanctions, only the promise there'll be no new sanctions. Failing that, AIPAC demands that Washington should step up sanctions. New sanctions would include, quote, penalizing countries that continue to buy Iranian oil in violation of U.S. law, including China. Measures should target the financial institutions, shipping firms, and ports of those countries. It was currently not reported by the mainstream media as that those sanctions, as others that are currently in force, would actually be against other countries with which the U.S. is at peace and with which it has important economic relations, such as China. For these vende patrias, however, Israel's interests always come first. Quote, Congress and the Obama administration must continue to send a strong message that all options are on the table, says the AIPAC statement, and that the United States is prepared to use all instruments of American power to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon capability. The United States must support Israel's right to act against Iran if it feels compelled in its own legitimate self-defense to act, end quote. Current U.S. policy says nothing about preventing Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon capability, only the weapon itself. But AIPAC and its lackeys in Congress continue to ignore that important distinction. Moreover, you may recall that back in May, I reported that the Senate had passed by unanimous roll call vote, 99-0, Senate Resolution 65, which called on the U.S. to support Israel politically, economically, and militarily should it choose to attack Iran. It was a story that the mainstream media, including Democracy Now!, completely ignored. Turning our attention to Syria, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has accused the U.S. of pushing Russia into approving a U.N. resolution that would allow for military intervention in Syria in exchange for American support of Syria's joining the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, or OPCW. Our American partners are starting to blackmail us, said Lavrov. If Russia does not support a resolution under Chapter 7, they say, then the U.S. will withdraw its support for Syria's entry into the OPCW. This is a complete departure from what I agree with Secretary of State John Kerry, Lavrov told Russian television Sunday. Chapter 7 of the U.N. Charter would allow for military intervention in Syria, and its inclusion as part of U.N. resolution would almost guarantee a Russian veto. Our partners are blinded by an ideological mission for regime change, said Lavrov. They cannot admit that they have made another mistake, end quote. Criticizing the West intervention in Libya and Iraq, the Russian foreign minister stated that military intervention could only lead to a catastrophe in the region. Lavrov pointed out that in the case of a military scenario, militants would come to power and Syria would no longer be a secular state. Up to three-quarters of these guys are jihadists, said Lavrov, including the most radical groups such as al-Nusra Front and the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant, who want to create an Islamic caliphate in Syria and in neighboring countries. Lavrov may have been exaggerating the numbers, but only slightly. A new report from defense analyst Janes puts the overall number of opposition fighters at 100,000 strong, half of whom it estimates to be quote-unquote jihadists, by the Western definition. and it is made up of some 100,000 different factions. Al-Qaeda reportedly directly commands the loyalty of about 10,000 of those fighters. Another 30,000 to 35,000 of the so-called rebels are jihadists from pro-Al-Qaeda factions that aren't explicitly run by the group, and still 30,000 more represent various Islamic factions of a somewhat more moderate character. What remains, according to Jaynes, is a secular component, a relatively small minority in the grand scheme of things, made doubly so by the fact that the Al-Qaeda-run forces like Jabhat al-Nusra have been dramatically more formidable in the actual fighting. Leave it to Senator John McCain, whose lust for war seems endless, to question Jaynes' statistics. As to which side actually employed chemical weapons, Peter Van Buren, writing on Huffington Post, points out how Secretary of State has distorted the findings of the UN inspector's report. He writes, John Kerry says it confirmed that the Assad regime fired the gas rockets. Unfortunately, that's not what the actual report says, writes Van Buren. In a court, Kerry's case might be seen as circumstantial at best, and certainly not enough for a jury to return a guilty verdict at a murder trial. And what did the UN inspectors learn, asked Kerry rhetorically? They returned with several crucial details that confirmed that the Assad regime is guilty of carrying out that attack, even though that was not the mandate of the UN report. But anybody who reads the facts and puts the dots together, which is easy to do, and they made it easy to do, understands what those facts mean. That was John Kerry, end quote. The problem is that the report does not confirm anything other than that chemical weapons were used. No one is named as a culprit. On the other hand, Robert Fisk, writing in The Independent from Damascus, notes that, quote, information is now circulating in the city that Russia's new evidence about the attack, exculpating the Syrian government, includes the dates of export of the specific rockets used and, more importantly, the countries to which they were originally sold. They were apparently manufactured in the Soviet Union in 1967 and sold by Moscow to three Arab countries, Yemen, Egypt, and Muammar Gaddafi's Libya. Since Gaddafi's fall in 2011, writes Fisk, vast quantities of his abandoned Soviet-made arms have fallen into the hands of rebel groups and Al-Qaeda-affiliated insurgents. Many were later found in Mali, some in Algeria, and a vast amount in Sinai. The Syrians have long claimed that a substantial amount of Soviet-made weaponry has made its way from Libya into the hands of rebels in the country's civil war with the help of Qatar, writes Fisk, which supported the Libyan rebels against Gaddafi and now pays for arms shipments to Syrian insurgents. There is no doubt that Syria has a substantial chemical weapons armory, notes Robert Fisk, nor that Syrian stockpiles contain large amounts of sarin gas 122-millimeter missiles. But if the Russians have indeed been able to identify the specific missile markings on fragments found in Ghouta, and if these are from the munitions never exported to Syria, the Assad regime will boast its innocence has been proven. I very much doubt that you will get that information from the mainstream U.S. media. I have never been a supporter of the Syrian government or any of the other dictatorship, but what the war in Syria is as it stands today and has stood for at least the last year is not about dictatorship or, for that matter, democracy. It's not about good guys versus bad guys. Despite its beginnings as a legitimate nonviolent campaign for political reform, not regime change, the conflict in Syria was quickly and deliberately transformed into a proxy war. On the one side is the unholy alliance of Israel, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, and to be sure, the United States. On the other are three countries that have stood in the way of American, Israeli, and Saudi domination of the region, namely Iran, Syria, and Lebanon, or more precisely Hezbollah, the resistance movement and political organization that arose in response to Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982, and which has been the only obstacle standing in the way of that country falling under Israeli domination. In what may seem to some to be a return to the Cold War, the latter trio has been supported in every critical way by Russia, whose oft-criticized President Vladimir Putin has ironically become, at least for the moment, what might be called the Prince of Peace in the Middle East. Well, that was to be the end of today's commentary. But late last night, I received word that a new Islamic bloc, led by the Jabhat al-Nusra Front and representing 13 rebel factions who make up the majority of the opposition forces, had declared its opposition to the National Coalition of Syria on the Exiles and to U.S. strategy. Their statement had 4 points. All military and civilian forces should unify their ranks in, quote, an Islamic framework based on the rule of Sharia and making it the sole source of legislation. Second, that they could only be represented by those who lived in and sacrificed for the revolution. Third, that they are not represented by any of the exile groups, that's speaking of the outsiders, and that for everyone inside needs to unite behind this Islamic group and avoid internal conflicts.